Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A few weeks ago, the government announced this year's Nuclear Posture Review, which breaks with longstanding international and bipartisan consensus that nuclear-armed nations should work to reduce and eliminate their nuclear arsenals. This year's Nuclear Posture Review calls for, quote, more usable nuclear weapons and expands the list of scenarios in which we might actually use nuclear weapons. Today we talk with Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action, about who put Dr. Strangelove back in charge of our nuclear weapons policy. Kevin, welcome to Locus Focus.
Glad to be with you.
Well, I wanted to start by just talking about what kind of inklings did you feel during the campaign in 2016 when you'd hear then-candidate Trump talking about why we should use these nuclear weapons that we're so busy making?
Well, you know, it was a foreshadowing of a president who didn't really want to be president or didn't have an idea what being president would mean. But, you know, he said things like, let it be an arms race, and he supposedly asked three times a retired general who was briefing him on national security issues, why, if we have all these nuclear weapons, we can't use them. Now, we'll get to this a little bit later. The United States does use nuclear weapons all the time. We haven't dropped a bomb on anybody since Nagasaki in 1945, but we use nuclear weapons to intimidate and to extort countries all the time. So they are, in fact, used. Daniel Ellsberg is one of the people that talks about that, but so do others. But certainly, I was no big fan of Hillary Clinton, and she's a hawk in a lot of ways. But, you know, Trump and his ignorance to this day, not just back in the campaign, is frightening.
And how does this new nuclear posture review that came out a few weeks ago that we're nominally talking about today, I mean, how does that reflect maybe a shift between the way that Trump thinks and the way that some of his predecessors think?
Maybe not as big of a shift as one would think. The war machine really doesn't care who's president. And when you look at some of the very exorbitant weapon systems that, of course, are paid for by our tax dollars, a lot of these weapon systems are in the pipeline for decades, sometimes before we even hear of them. Even though it's our tax dollars, we're often not allowed to know. And if you look at the so-called nuclear modernization, $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years to completely upgrade and overhaul our entire nuclear weapons complex, that was started under President Obama, not under President Trump. So some of the rhetoric and some of the tensions and some of the threats to develop more usable nuclear weapons or to use them under new circumstances is maybe a bit of a change, but there's really probably more continuity than there is a break with his predecessors.
Well, actually, one of the things that disturbed me, one of the many things during the campaign in 2016, was when Trump attacked Obama and by association Hillary Clinton for being soft on our nuclear strategy and that we had this aging weapon system that was not any way to rival all the ways that the Russians were now, you know, building the great weapon system that Putin just unveiled a couple weeks ago, that I was concerned that the Democrats shot back with what you were just describing is the whole nuclear modernization plan that Obama was had undertaken. And I hadn't really known about it until I heard that back and forth. And it was, I found dismaying to think, why are we modernizing our nuclear weapons when we are supposedly trying to disarm the world?
Right. And President Obama, of course, talked about both when he was running for president and then when he was in office, pursuing a world, the security of a world without nuclear weapons. But then he added the caveat that perhaps it wouldn't happen in his lifetime. Well, what does that tell you? That just makes, to me, it just sounds like you're not serious. If you said, we want quality education for all children in this country, but it may not happen in my lifetime. Or, you know, we want to protect immigrants, but it may not happen in my lifetime. We want health care for all, but may not happen in my lifetime. People would say, well, you're not serious, are you? And, you know, Obama did some good things. The Iran nuclear agreement was certainly very good. We supported that. But part of the problem, again, like I said before, the war machine doesn't care who's president, and the president is less in charge of the war machine than you would think. So this New START treaty, relatively modest treaty with Russia, to reduce by one-third the biggest, baddest deployed strategic nuclear weapons, a supposed deal to get Senate ratification for that was this quote-unquote nuclear modernization. And we shouldn't call it modernization. We should call it a new arms race, because that's what it is. predictably, all the other eight nuclear states announced in a monkey-see, monkey-do policy, except that's an insult to monkeys. They wouldn't be so foolish. Every other nuclear state said, we're going to upgrade and modernize our nuclear weapons, too. So it's a new arms race started by the United States. But even going back further, and this is, I think, a key point we don't often talk about, our tax dollars pay for nuclear and defense, quote-unquote defense, military, or Pentagon is a better word, and foreign policies that make us less safe. And not just nuclear policy. So I talked a little bit about the spur to proliferation of this $1.7 trillion escalation, but also our conventional policies, like NATO expansion, has made Russia more dependent on their nuclear weapons for their defense rather than less. So that means me and you and our children are less safe because of policies funded by our tax dollars.
Well, one of the things that seems apparent about the dangers of encouraging nuclear proliferation is what's going on with North Korea and what they are using as an excuse and perhaps actually as a model of why they're developing a nuclear program is that they perceive that Iraq and Libya went down the tubes because they abandoned their nuclear programs. And the only way to be able to confront U.S. conventional military power and the alliances that North Korea sees with the United States, Japan, and South Korea is to have this nuclear arsenal that they can at least wave around like a red flag. So it seems that this is that we need to like maybe talk about the nuclear arms race, as you just suggested, in a different way. It's not just matching arms for nuclear arms for nuclear arms, but it's looking at the whole militaristic picture.
Well, that's exactly right. And actually, I couldn't have said it better. And working to support peace and diplomacy and to avoid a war with North Korea is actually the main thing that I work on, and I convene something called the Korea Collaboration and the Korea Peace Network, which is a network of grassroots activists all over the country who are working to promote diplomacy. And we did have some good news over the weekend that South Korea is going to send two diplomats to meet with North Korea, and even President Trump said that the United States is going to talk to North Korea, although predictably he offered, you know, no specifics about that. But there is an unfortunate logic for North Korea, and I don't want anybody to have nuclear weapons. They should all be abolished by 5 o'clock this afternoon. I'm in favor of abolishing everything above super soakers, if you really get down to it, okay?
But
there is a logic.
Wait, what's a super soaker?
There is a logic. Super soakers? Yeah. You know what they are?
No.
They're big water squirt guns.
Oh, okay, okay.
they look like machine guns, but they shoot water. So, you know, there is a logic. And people talk about Kim Jong-un being crazy or whatever. He's ruthless. He's terrible in a lot of ways, but he's not crazy. He is wanting to preserve his power and his family's power. And there is a logic to North Korea wanting to develop nuclear weapons. And this is one of these we reap what we sow kinds of things. And if you look back at the history of this, I think the United States missed a huge opportunity at the end of the Cold War to really change the dynamic about international security and relying not only less on nuclear weapons, but to get serious about abolishing nuclear weapons, which we haven't done, obviously.
Have you seen the article in the New York Times this morning, A Russian Threat on Two Fronts Meets an American Strategic Void?
I didn't see that. I saw something similar in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So it was responding to Putin's nonsensical presentation last week about these new souped-up nukes. Was it the same thing? I didn't see the Times.
Yeah, actually, the Times, I actually caught it this morning, and I read it over breakfast to prepare talking to you. And
you didn't get indigestion? I would think you would.
No, I was kind of prepared at this point. But basically, it was interesting. It's an analysis in the Times, and they were saying a whole lot of the same things that you say in your article about a lot of the reasons why this arms race with Russia has escalated. And it's not just Trump, but it has to do with other military policies the United States has kind of been escalating that are non-nuclear, and that started probably under Clinton, and certainly and the tension with Putin and the United States, that it explains some of the justification that Putin might have in his mind for why he showed his wonderful video last week and did you get to watch the video? I actually watched it this morning, and except that I don't take anything. I mean, I take everything seriously. I mean, it was really ridiculous, and it's something that, you know, you'd see on a Saturday morning cartoon show for strange children. But it was it gave me a sense, you know, that there's even amongst kind of the threat in this country, which is pretty strongly anti-Russia, anti-Putin, really afraid of, you know, the other things, the very undemocratic aspects of Putin's regime, but that there are reasons that we haven't been really looking at about why Putin, very much like Kim Il-jong, might be wanting to up the ante of his nuclear arsenal. And what if we can talk about what some of that, the things that have unfolded with NATO and other things in the last decade or two decades that might make Russia kind of nervous?
Definitely. There are two, and just to say, I went to Russia once in 1997, and I loved it. And the people, the culture, the food, and Russians are just like anybody else. Now, they're saddled with this very undemocratic, unfortunately, system of government right now. But the Russian people and the American people have no reason to hate each other or fear each other. It's our stupid governments that get in the way and our huge military-industrial complexes. Two things, and this can go back to what I would call post-Cold War triumphalism. We won the Cold War, so you have to eat our garbage and like it. You know, that's the arrogance of the United States. The first George Bush Sr., had made a pledge not to expand NATO eastward, and Clinton broke that. And so the United States and NATO has been expanding eastward right up to Russia's borders. And so Russia understandably sees that as a threat. We would, too, if there was a military alliance that now had expanded up to including Mexico or Canada. It's not hard to understand why. So that was number one. Number two, George Bush, the second George Bush, and I really hate this sort of normalization of George W. Bush's presidency just because in comparison to Trump, he looked like a liberal or some nonsense. That's garbage, okay? Way more people died under George Bush than so far have under Trump. George Bush is abrogating the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, pretty much, and again, this is out of post-Cold War triumphalism and arrogance, pretty much handed Putin the reason that he would want to develop new types of nuclear weapons to be able to overwhelm our missile defense system. Even though missile defense doesn't work, it's the worst boondoggle. You might as well just have flushed the money down the toilet, the billions and billions and billions of dollars on missile defense. Any adversary would have to think, well, if they can develop a missile defense, we need more missiles or better missiles or souped-up missiles or crazy nuclear cruise missiles, which is one of the things that was on Putin's video last week, to be able to defeat missile defense. So again, those two things have made Russia, and it makes sense as to why, it's logical why Russia would, and they can't afford it even worse than we can't afford it in terms of investing more in their nuclear weapons and investing, you know, more of their defense on their nuclear weapons, which again makes us less safe, makes the whole world less safe.
I just had a thought of one of the things that really destroyed the Soviet Union and brought down Gorbachev was the way that Russia, or the Soviet Union at that time, dumps all their money into weapons and into the military. And it was a losing proposition for them. Do you see the same thing might be the undoing of Putin?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about the state of the Russian economy and society at this point. Also, so I mentioned this article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists that came out yesterday by a colleague here in Washington named Sharon Squassoni, and it says, Threat Assessment, Potemkin Putin versus the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review. And she and a lot of other people say that the stuff that Putin brought out last week, either A, a lot of it was known for years that they were working on this, or B, it's nonsense that's never going to come online, it's never actually going to be fielded. So some of it is just sort of fantastical nonsense. So whether it's going to bankrupt Russia, that's a really good question. I certainly hope not, because the Russian people don't deserve that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Kevin Martin, who's president of the Peace Action, and you are based in Maryland?
Yeah, just outside of Washington, D.C. We also have an office in Oakland, and we have chapters and affiliates all over the country.
And you're listening to us here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG FM in Seattle. And we're talking this morning about a question that Kevin Martin raised in some articles he's written since the Nuclear Posture Review the first pre-draft was released. Who put Dr. Strangelove back in charge of our nuclear weapons policy? So let's talk for a moment, for those people who are younger than either you or I, who Dr. Strangelove is and why we wouldn't want him in charge of our policy.
One of the greatest movies of all time by Stanley Kubrick, and it is about a nuclear war. And you think, how could that possibly be funny? But every time I watch it, I laugh. And it's this sort of parody if you can do it, and that's what's the genius of it. And, of course, the acting by Peter Sellers, who plays several roles, including Dr. Strangelove, but also the U.S. president, is just priceless. And it is the nonsensical but logical conclusion to a nuclear arms race, including the so-called Russian doomsday machine or Soviet doomsday machine, which is sort of the dead hand that launches the nuclear war that ends, well, you think anyway, ends life on Earth. And they hadn't told the U.S. about it. And the U.S. generals say, well, why hadn't you told, maybe the president too, why hadn't you told us about that? Because, you know, deterrence doesn't work if we don't know that you have this weapon. And that's, it's just sort of, the absurdity of the nuclear arms race, unfortunately, is still relevant today and maybe even more relevant. One of the best films ever made, as far as I'm concerned.
We were actually talking about this last night on the phone, but the difference, and Kevin's my age, is the difference in my first reaction when I saw Dr. Strangelove, which was right about a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was right before Kevin was born. And so I got to see Dr. Strangelove after having almost, you know, thought we were going to be living through a nuclear war. And I did not find it funny when I was 14 and saw it, or 13. It was really, really frightening. Later on, I would agree with Kevin, it's the funniest movie I think I've ever seen. But it sort of showed, as we were having this conversation last night, that the difference in when you grew up makes a real difference in your sense about the imminence of nuclear war. And since I grew up with duck and cover and, you know, going out into the hallways in our grade school and putting our heads between our legs and our hands over our heads, and that was going to save us from a nuclear attack, it does something. It's kind of like growing up now with climate change, I guess. And, you know, you're just always on the edge when you're a little kid thinking the world's going to end. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we had the first of a number of nuclear treaties that reduced testing and eventually started calling for graduated disarmament, I think the fear of nuclear war really receded until recently. And I was thinking this morning that it used to be like nuclear war, the fear of nuclear war was kind of like our fear of polio or smallpox, which we thought we'd eradicated. But obviously with those diseases and with nuclear war, you can never eradicate it. So where are we now in terms of why has it reared its ugly head again, and how much more in danger are we now than we were at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, since I was born in November of 62, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was the first child in my family, my mother thought I was never going to be born. She would never see her first child. I can say that I believe it is the most dangerous in my lifetime. And that's not at all to downplay the Cold War or to be nostalgic about the Cold War or to say that there was some logical or adult balancing of understanding the risks. I thought Ronald Reagan was going to start a nuclear war. I thought he was nuts. I thought he was reckless and his, you know, calling the Soviet Union an evil empire. I really did think that Reagan could start a nuclear war. And so he really recruited me into being a peace and disarmament advocate. Now, of course, by the end of his term, he was reducing nuclear weapons. But he and Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, actually did talk for a few minutes about maybe a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons. And the reason he couldn't do it was so-called strategic defense initiative or missile defense. And if he had given that up because it's ridiculous and it doesn't work and it costs a ton of money, who knows? Maybe we might be well on the road or even have abolished nuclear weapons by now if we could have made that deal then. But they couldn't do it. You know, Reagan couldn't do it. So this lionizing of Reagan is garbage. I don't buy that at all. Plus, humans are too stupid to be entrusted with these weapons that could end life on Earth. There have been some great books out the last few years about all the near misses. There was a great book and movie about the man who saved the world, a Russian colonel whose name I'm forgetting right now off the top of my head, but he had less than 2 minutes to decide on whether he should advocate a nuclear strike or not. And it looked like there was an incoming missile attack from the United States on the Soviet Union. It turned out it was a Norwegian weather satellite, but their radar mistook it for a nuclear attack. He was within, you know, he had less than 2 minutes to decide whether to advocate that the Soviet Union would launch launch a strike. And there have been a lot of other near misses or problems, including on the United States side. A missile flew out of a missile silo in Montana by mistake. Luckily, the warhead didn't go off. Just a few years ago, we flew on a plane that was supposed to be dummy warheads, but they were live warheads from either Montana or North Dakota down to Louisiana. There are two nuclear warheads that were dropped by U.S. planes, one off the coast of North Carolina, one off the coast of Georgia. We can't be entrusted with this technology. We are too stupid, too fallible. Humans make mistakes. So it doesn't matter really what era you're talking about. The threat never went away. The sort of genius of the nuclear weapons establishment that keeps getting funded lavishly year after year with our tax dollars is what you might call nuclear weapons forgotten but not gone. So the threat of nuclear weapons has been forgotten. And if you talk to young people today that didn't grow up during the Cold War, they don't know a whole lot about nuclear weapons at all because it wasn't something that they thought of as a threat. But the weapons have never gone away, and they've been a threat all this time.
Well, I was thinking about the other end of near misses, which was examples of the false nuclear alerts in Hawaii and Japan.
Oh, my word.
And that does something else to, I imagine it could age people quite a bit when you're living under, in the case of Hawaii, it was like 35 minutes before they were notified that it was a false alarm.
Well, and I haven't heard anyone die, but what if somebody was in a panic and, you know, had a traffic accident and died because of that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking just the age. I mean, when you go through that kind of fear, I would think that that's kind of a life-changing experience.
One would hope. but, you know, the immediate reaction was not let's get rid of these horrible things. It's let's work on our, you know, early warning system, blah, 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 which, of course, they should work on the early warning system. Now, of course, the threat there is North Korea could probably hit Hawaii with a nuclear weapon. They probably cannot hit the continental mainland of the United States, but probably can hit South Korea, Guam, Hawaii, Japan with a nuclear warhead on a missile. Now, they shouldn't need to or want to, and you know, we should be mutually deterred, right? Their forces and the United States and South Korean forces should be mutually deterring each other, if you really even believe in deterrence theory. I believe in disarmament much more than I believe in deterrence theory. And it's really bizarre now because you have, again, the nine nuclear weapon states all upgrading their nuclear forces. And in the United States case, it's soup to nuts. It's from our laboratories, our warheads, submarines, missiles, planes. It's just staggering. Again, $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years. But it'll surely be more than that. There's never weapon systems that come in on budget or under budget. It's always more. So it's certainly going to be $2 trillion or more. So you have that going on with all the nuclear states. On the other hand, you have 122 countries who just last year at the United Nations signed a treaty to ban nuclear weapons globally. And so you have these two, you know, opposite directions that countries are going in. And clearly, I agree with the 122 countries that say we should be getting rid of these horrible things.
Well, I wonder, you know, thinking back to that false alarm of a nuclear attack in Hawaii, if that had happened a couple years ago, if people would have taken it as seriously, and what has been changing in the last year since Trump has been president that is putting us much more on edge?
No doubt Trump's threats. You know, him talking about fire and fury that we would unleash on North Korea like the world has never seen. At the United Nations, he threatened to completely destroy North Korea. There are 25 million human beings that live in North Korea. If you don't like their government, you don't like their leader, whatever. There's 25 million men, women, and children that live in that country. At the United Nations, he threatened to totally destroy North Korea. So, people should be more scared with Trump's finger on the button. That's one of the things that we promote and a lot of other organizations, too. A bill, you might call it the No Red Button bill, and a lot of people say this is just an anti-Trump bill, but it was actually introduced before the election when most people thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president. So it's not just a partisan thing. And it's in the Senate, S-200 by Ed Markey, and in the House, H-R-669 by Ted Lieu, saying that there needs to be a declaration of war from Congress for any president to initiate a nuclear first strike. And remember, and this gets to the larger question, and we can talk about this as well, in terms of Congress, according to the Constitution, only Congress can declare war, But that hasn't happened since World War II. And, of course, the United States has been involved in all kinds of wars, with Congress either shirking its responsibility or passing these authorizations for the use of military force. But none of that excuses any president by him or herself being able to start basically the end of humanity. There's a great book about this called Thermonuclear Monarchy by Elaine Scarry, S-C-A-R-R-Y. She's a Harvard professor and actually a peace action supporter. And she basically makes the point that nuclear weapons are the most fundamentally undemocratic thing, because one person, whether it's the U.S. president or the French prime minister or whoever, could start a nuclear war on their own. One person can decide to start a nuclear war that would end life on Earth. What could be less democratic than that? And so I think that's a great way to think of this. And again, this bill in Congress would say that no president could initiate a nuclear first strike without a declaration of war from Congress.
Well, along with that is also a bill that's being sponsored by Bernie Sanders and some other people that would require that the United States, that the Congress pass a resolution basically to get us out of having any kind of a connection with the war that's going on between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And I wonder if you see a connection between these two bills.
I do, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to bring it up. It's SJ Res 54, and it's going to be voted on probably. We don't know. The Senate is sort of crazy in terms of their operation and their bureaucracy, but probably going to be voted on in the next 2 weeks. Sanders and actually Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, are the two lead sponsors, and also Chris Murphy from Connecticut. And it basically says the United States has no business being involved in supporting the horrible Saudi attack on Yemen, which is the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world right now, according to the UN. 8 million people in Yemen are at risk of starvation, 1 million children at risk of cholera. It's horrible. Now, it would not stop the U.S. weapon sales, unfortunately, which we're in favor of that, obviously. What it would stop is U.S. support, in-flight refueling, without which the Saudi Arabian Air Force could not continue their airstrikes, targeting, intelligence, and other types of logistical support. And without that support from the United States, again, funded by our tax dollars, Saudi Arabia could not continue this brutal war on Yemen. Now, the way I do think it is somewhat related is, again, in terms of Congress reasserting its constitutional authority. Now, if this bill gets buried, which it shouldn't, or there's some kind of a deal or a trade-off, or if it loses badly, who knows? Trump might be emboldened. And even though you might say it's apples and oranges when you talk about North Korea or nuclear weapons or whatever, he might say, well, gosh, you know, a bunch of Democrats voted to try to get us out of this war, but they failed, so they sort of weren't able to step up to their constitutional responsibility. So, you know, I have a free hand to do whatever I want, North Korea or Iran or wherever. And not surprisingly, and we certainly have heard this going back to at least the George W. Bush administration, there's a memo that I believe has not been made public yet, basically saying that the administration feels like it doesn't need any kind of congressional authorization for any kind of military action it wants to do anywhere in the world, that the powers of the chief executive and the, you know, the head of the armed forces gives Trump unilateral ability to start wars anywhere. That should frighten everybody. Everybody needs to contact Congress and say, no, that's unacceptable. We don't want him to be able to start nuclear war by himself, and we also want to end this this horrible slaughter in Yemen. And again, it's important because of the humanitarian catastrophe, and secondarily, but still very important, the constitutional authority that Congress is supposed to have over matters of war and peace.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG FM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action, about who put Dr. Strangelove back in charge of our nuclear weapons policy. There's been a lot of talk over the weekend about how deranged Trump is and how isolated he is, which is making some people afraid that in this isolation he might lash out even more crazily, and not just with Twitter, but actually pushing some buttons that would end the world. And I've also read a lot of discussion about ways that the president can be curbed, whether it's by his advisors or whether it's by Congress. So I wanted to talk a little bit about if you see any current checks and balances to keep Trump from actually pushing the button that would end the world, or is something that really has to come from Congress?
Well, the problem is now when you talk about other than this Yemen vote, there are, so I talked about this sort of no red button, S-200 and H.R. 669, saying that no president, not just Trump, could initiate a nuclear war without a declaration of Congress. There's also something called the No Unconstitutional Strike on North Korea bill, H.R. 4837 by Ro Khanna from California, S-2016 by Ed Markey, also Jeff Merkley from Oregon as a co-sponsor of that, and Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The problem is none of those votes are likely under this Congress to even get a hearing, let alone get a vote. So they can be organizing opportunities or educational opportunities for activists to get people engaged. But in terms of actually putting a roadblock in front of Trump or any other president, it's not likely anytime soon because they're not likely to even have a hearing, let alone a vote. So then what does that mean? I think public opinion is certainly very important. I think Trump does care about that. I think a lot of Republicans care about that. But, you know, then there's like, well, you know, is Jim Mattis, is he the sane voice within the administration that would talk Trump off the ledge or would refuse to carry out an unconstitutional order or whatever it is? But again, then you're just talking about a very undemocratic system of war making. If you're depending on one person who's supposedly the adult in the room to talk Trump back or to refuse. I'm not comfortable with that, and I believe in people's movements. I believe in people rising up and demanding justice and demanding what's right. So I think that's where we have to put our focus. And even though I'm here in Washington, I really don't have any inside baseball speculation on who might stop Trump, but it is very, very scary, obviously.
When you were talking a little earlier about how Obama basically talked about disarmament, something that was definitely a goal, but maybe not within his own lifetime, one of the lessons that I've been taking from the students who have been rising up in the aftermath of the massacre at Parkland in Parkland, Florida, that I love listening to them talk because they sound like teenagers and they are really impatient and they want change now. And it reminds me of when I was young. And since then, I've grown up and thought, well, you have to go through processes. You have to be realistic. But when I hear these young people speaking and they just want it now and they see no reason why it can't happen now, I'm wondering if we can really channel that energy and maybe embody it ourselves and start to stop thinking in terms of, well, we have to do everything incrementally and it won't be in our lifetime. When, if we wait past our lifetime, there will be no planet left.
Yeah, I think the problem, though, is you really sort of can't manufacture urgency and you can't really even manufacture movements. You can try to build constituencies, build alliances, but also, I guess, two other points on this. So first of all, because you told me a little bit about your age. You know, the 60s and maybe early 70s wasn't just about ending the Vietnam War or civil rights. It was about building a fundamentally new, just society. And maybe that was unrealistic or utopian or whatever. We haven't seen anything like that since then. And the other point is, I think if you look at Dr. King's speech 50 years ago, Beyond Vietnam, he talked about the triple evils or the giant triplets of U.S. society. He talked about racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. I think were he alive today, he would be disappointed, certainly that we haven't overcome those three. But I think he'd also be disappointed that our movements and our constituencies are not connected nearly as well as they should be. And I think for a number of reasons, I think this country is in deep denial about our level of militarism. And I love what the students are doing, including some students here at a local high school where I live in Maryland, just outside of Washington. But I haven't seen them, and it wouldn't be realistic to see them talking about the larger links to, you know, bigger social ills like racism and militarism and economic exploitation. But, you know, again, I believe in people's movements, and building them usually is not quick, unfortunately.
So, what do you see is, I guess, another option that I was thinking in terms of getting some of these bills you mentioned off the ground, if we can survive until next November and we can take back the House and the Senate and in the hands, hopefully, of some people who are more determined to promulgate our society into the future. What do you see as the path to get there? And do you think that that would make a difference if we actually had the Democrats in control of the Congress?
Somewhat, but Democrat does not equal peacenik. There are plenty of Democrats that take a lot of money from the war machine So here's a very little known fact. And I supported Bernie Sanders, and we actually endorsed Sanders, which we normally don't endorse for president. My organization, Peace Action, hadn't endorsed anybody for president since Clinton the first time, 1992. And I was against it then, and I was right that we shouldn't have endorsed him. But of all of the candidates running for president last year, and this is going back to the primaries, Bernie Sanders was actually number two in donations from weapons contractors. Number one was Lindsey Graham. Number two was Bernie Sanders. And part of this is because Lockheed Martin, which makes the F-35, which is the most ludicrously expensive weapon system so far to date, and they're going to modify it, according to this nuclear posture review, to carry nuclear weapons. Lockheed Martin makes the F-35, and they want to base F-35s at the Burlington, Vermont airport. So even Bernie Sanders, who most people think is not a peacenik, certainly more inclined towards peace than others, was number two in terms of weapons contractor donations. So I certainly would like the Democrats to be back in charge of both houses of Congress. I think that may be possible. We are one of the few peace groups that does make endorsements of House and Senate races, and we certainly will be supporting pro-peace candidates, but people should not equate Democrats with pacifism or peaceniks, because there's plenty of Democrats that unfortunately are not even close to that.
Well, actually, in some of these districts where there's hopes amongst the Democrats that they might be able to flip them from red to blue, a lot of these people that are running are veterans of recent wars, and they, I think, are very pro-military. So I think that we're going to, if the Democrats do take back the Senate and the House in next fall, that it's going to be more like it was in 2008 when Obama won with massive Democratic majorities. That'll be a lot of conservative Democrats, which make it harder to have a progressive agenda. But
definitely true, because there were people that wanted, and I thought there was certainly plenty of reason to try to impeach George W. Bush when the Democrats still controlled the House. And the people that we talked to said, sorry, we don't have the votes. Even though the Democrats control the House, we don't have the votes. We can't do it. I actually think maybe one of the most important keys, and it is to me, the most urgent priority, is to avoid war with North Korea. I think we basically have a month, or maybe a little more, but not a whole lot more, to avoid what could be a catastrophe in terms of a possible U.S. attack on North Korea, which we are definitely getting ready for. The United States is getting ready for that attack. But again, I do think there is the possibility of preventing that, at least buying some time. The incredible peace initiative of President Moon of South Korea, the wonderful coincidence of the Olympics having been in South Korea. Thank God they were not in Italy or France or Utah or somewhere this year. There's this thing called the Olympic Truce, which goes actually till a week after the Paralympics, that we've been organizing around. And the U.S., you know, Trump did one good thing, which is he agreed with President Moon's request to postpone the massive war exercises that the U.S. and South Korea do until after the Olympics. Now, there's some talk that maybe they'll continue to suspend those, and South Korea has supposedly asked for more time to allow for more negotiations with North Korea, more talks, and it makes a lot of sense to continue to postpone these massive war exercises. And this is part of sort of the war machine on autopilot that most people don't even know about, again, even though it's our tax dollars. These huge, twice a year, they're the biggest war exercises anywhere on the planet. 200,000 South Korean troops, and I think between 10 and 20,000 U.S. troops. And they don't just practice, they practice a land invasion. They practice with B-52s, fake or simulated nuclear bombing attacks on North Korea, and what they call decapitation, taking out the North Korean leadership. No wonder North Korea hates these and loathes these war exercises. So at least you could say, well, this is a bargaining chip, and Trump did the right thing in postponing them until after the Olympics. He should continue to postpone them, and evidently there has been a request from the South Korean president. And again, Trump said over the weekend that he wants to talk to North Korea, although no details. And South Korea is sending two senior-level diplomats to Pyongyang. So I think there is some momentum there for peace and diplomacy, and we absolutely have to avoid a catastrophe that could turn into a nuclear war. And we don't have a lot of time. So I think that's really what we need to focus on. And if we're able to win on that issue, it would be phenomenal and may have an impact on some of these other issues that we're talking about.
Well, one of the things you read about is a freeze for a freeze. So what is that?
Well, we have a de facto freeze for a freeze now, and that has to do with, on the one side, North Korea freezing their missile testing and their nuclear weapons testing, and then on the U.S. and South Korea side, to freeze these war games or war exercises, war drills. They're not games. You should never use the word games. And so that's in place right now, and we need to extend that. And one of the things that supposedly is under discussion, even though the United States doesn't admit to any formal diplomacy with North Korea, and there isn't any as far as we know, but some back channel or what's sometimes called track 2 or track 1.5, basically non-official talks, is that either we would continue to postpone the war exercises or we might modify them to take the most loathsome and terrifying to North Korea out of the exercises. So scale back the exercises. Don't do the simulated nuclear bombing attacks. Don't do the simulated decapitation raids that would kill the North Korean leadership. Don't do the massive land invasion. So it's possible that that is, well, I'm told by independent journalists who I think I trust and know what they're talking about, that that is at least not under discussion.
So what do you think the chances are that there are other forces, like, for instance, South Korea, that might be able to preempt the United States' efforts of stirring up a war with North Korea?
I think it's absolutely the key right now. And as important as some of the things we were talking about in terms of organizing in this country to get members of Congress to speak out against war with North Korea or to sign on to this No Unconstitutional Strike on North Korea Act, supporting President Moon of South Korea and his peace initiative is, I think, absolutely the most important. Now, the other thing that people talk about is, behind the scenes, could Russia or China be playing a helpful role? That's really hard to say, and we don't, frankly, as people in this country, have much influence over what the government of Russia or China does. You would think that they would be sending a chastening message to the Trump administration about all this stuff, but I do think that supporting South Korea, and it also has to do with South Korean sovereignty. So just a couple examples of that. First of all, President Moon of South Korea, he wasn't able to cancel or postpone the war games. He had to ask Trump, and Trump had to agree. There is a big dog and little dog imperial equation here, even though South Korea, you know, is an independent country. But a lot of people don't know that the status of forces agreement between the U.S. and South Korea for at least a few more years says that if a war breaks out, the South Korean forces are under the command of a U.S. general, not a South Korean general. Now, that's going to change in, it's either 2 or 4 years, but I think a lot of people don't know about that. So the fact that maybe President Moon is somewhat capitalizing on the Trump administration's incompetence and disorganization, he's maybe being more aggressive than I would have thought, and I think he deserves all the credit in the world for that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG FM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Kevin Martin, who is president of Peace Action. And we're talking about the Nuclear Posture Review, which was released a few weeks ago, which makes it changes our policy, basically, in nuclear weapons, moving away from deterrence and more towards finding useful ways to use nuclear weapons, which would, fulfill some of the Trump's campaign fantasies. I wanted to get back to Russia and sort of the motivations, or let's look at how real the nuclear threat is from Russia. Is it possible that we could move back into the level of mutually assured destruction that we lived under during the Cold War?
Well, we still live under that. And when you talk about deterrence, and the word deterrence is thrown around as if it has some kind of magical power, if you really unpack, what does deterrence mean? It means threatening to incinerate millions of humans in another country to provide for our security. It's totally immoral, totally unjustified, and very unstable. Because again, any nuclear accident, or you know, any accident could escalate into something catastrophic. I don't think you're going to see the U.S. and Russia go back to the enormous numbers of nuclear weapons that we had during the Cold War, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the numbers we have now are enough to end life on the planet. So to me, it's and the thing is, there was an understanding, and there should be an understanding now, that regardless of whatever enmity there is between the U.S. and Russia, and of course there's plenty now, You know, life on a planet is more important than whatever political arguments we have right now. So there's no reason we shouldn't be talking to Russia and saying, you know what, let's not do this. Let's not spend trillions of dollars on more weapons that would just make the rubble bounce higher. We can already destroy all life on Earth if we want. Let's not do that. Let's negotiate, you know, further limitations. Let's negotiate further reductions, you know, in nuclear weapons. That would be, you know, far smarter. I actually fear now, though, that Trump politically could not do it because he would have so little credibility. Everybody would say, oh, you're Putin's lapdog and, you know, you love Russia and you owe a bunch of money to Russian oligarchs or whatever it is, whatever this, and I don't know any more than anybody else does, whatever the relationship is that Trump has with Russia, that people, including Democrats who otherwise might support arms control or arms reduction, would say, no, Trump, you can't get away with that. We don't trust you because we think that you're in Putin's pocket or whatever. But that's, you know, that's holding humanity hostage over God knows what, you know, Trump's relationship is with Putin or with the Russians.
Well, actually, I think that's a really kind of tangled question to unravel because,
yeah, it sure
I
is.
Mean, as you're saying, I'm thinking, like, I don't trust Putin. And on the one hand, I don't trust him. Partly, I don't take him seriously. Well, his little video was something that was very hard to take serious. And,
right.
And he seems very puffed up. And you just wonder, I mean, he feels as puffed up as Trump is, actually.
Only well, he's up for re-election in a week and a half.
Right. And his whole thing about making, I mean, I thought his speech was kind of interesting where he's talking about all this, these wonderful domestic programs he was going to be providing for the Russian people and, you know, how wonderful their life was going to be. And we have this military power where we can trounce the United States. And the whole thing felt like, very much like campaign, empty campaign promises. But I found it interesting that he was talking so much about domestic welfare in that speech, which you don't usually hear him talking about. But I'm nervous, for instance, that the parties that won the most votes in Italy yesterday are very pro-Putin. And so there's, as much as I want to see world peace and I want to see nuclear disarmament, when you're one of the players that you're dealing with is somebody who's so untrustworthy, it's kind of hard to overcome that. So I wonder, how do we overcome that hurdle?
You know, no one's ever tried this in a serious way, although I did mention, I guess maybe you could say Reagan sort of did. If you go back to Reagan and Gorbachev, actually talking about a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons, no one since at least has tried it. I think, and maybe Trump, again, maybe it's just impossible politically because where Trump is, but I think if a U.S. president went to Putin or whoever in Russia and said, let's get together and lead the world towards, if not total nuclear disarmament, towards you know, serious reductions and being serious about nonproliferation, I don't think they could say no. I think they would have to say yes because they cannot afford this even more than we can. If you look at this $1.7 trillion plan here in the United States, you know, that's money that's not going to schools or affordable housing or infrastructure or transit or building the green economy. We can't afford it. Well, they even more can't afford it. And same with China and same with all the other countries. But there's no leadership on that right now. Again, the thing about this nuclear weapons ban treaty that's such a head-scratcher, 122 countries, majority of the world's countries, signed on to this last year. However, those are all countries that don't have nuclear weapons and that already gave up the right to have nuclear weapons under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So they're not actually giving up anything. They're making a sort of a pox on all your houses statement that the U.S. and Russia and the other nuclear states have not gotten serious about nuclear disarmament, which they are supposed to under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Doesn't say that the original five nuclear powers can keep their nuclear weapons forever. As a matter of fact, Article 6 says that we're supposed to be negotiating towards getting rid of nuclear weapons, which of course we're not doing. We're doing the opposite. We're working on upgrading our nuclear weapons. But if there were leadership, if the countries got together and said, this is madness, and we need to invest in the planet and our people instead of these death machines, let's stop doing this, I think that we could make progress. But right now, there's just really no leadership in the international realm other than these countries giving up something that they didn't have in the first place. But it's a moral and hopefully a legal statement, too, that the world needs to move towards nuclear disarmament.
Well, I'm wondering, besides the United States and Russia and North Korea, I mean, you don't really hear the other nuclear powers doing the same kind of saber-rattling. I'm wondering if there's any movement among countries like France and England and even China to maybe start pushing towards complete disarmament.
Well, so of the original five, so you know, the four that have developed nuclear weapons most recently, North Korea, Israel, India, and Pakistan, put those aside for a second. Not that we should. I mean, they're all very dangerous, and they should all get rid of them tomorrow. But the original five, China has actually long been fairly responsible. They've had a no-first-use policy, and their arsenals are relatively small and can credibly be said, and they've stated this in their policy over and over again, that they are a small deterrent force only because the U.S. and Russia have these giant forces. And they've basically indicated that they would move towards nuclear disarmament, including they've been promoting a treaty to ban weapons in outer space. France and Britain, it's ridiculous. What in the world do they need nuclear weapons for? And the U.K., and I have a lot of Scottish and Irish and also some English heritage, the U.K. maybe is, of the existing nuclear states, they have a very small arsenal, and they're all at one submarine base in Scotland, and I have Scottish heritage, and I really want them to shut down that base. And if they did, they have no other base. They'd actually have to give their nuclear weapons to France or the United States. That's what the plan is. And the Scottish independence vote, which failed, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, the main Scottish party, they are for nuclear disarmament and for kicking those U.K. nukes out of that submarine base. So my colleagues in the U.K., they really are working on that and want to make that happen. But basically, none of those countries really have the stature or the status or the power to provide serious leadership. Now, if a bunch of them got together, maybe so, but I just don't see it happening anytime soon, unfortunately.
So what do you think people can do here, my listeners, our listeners, to change the conversation, actually really kickstart the conversation about why we need to get rid of the nuclear weapons that are threatening the Earth?
Well, so I do make the connection, what you said earlier about the Yemen vote, that people should contact their senators in favor of SJ Res 54. And again, it's necessary to stop the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, but also to reassert Congress's authority over war and peace. Then they should also be supporting the No Unconstitutional First Strike on North Korea, S-2016 in the Senate, H.R. 4837 in the House. I also think just local education and organizing, particularly around North Korea, and doing whatever we can to support the South Korean president's diplomacy, because I think right now that is the most important thing. I think he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize already for what he's been doing. Now, of course, we need to see a payoff, but you know, I think his initiative is absolutely the most important thing right now in walking back from the brink, because if it were up to Trump, I mean, God knows. And the problem is, even if Trump didn't decide he wanted to start a war, there's always the danger of miscalculation or a mistake leading to escalation. You could have some nervous North Korean private, you know, start a war because he thinks the United States is invading or something. You know, the risk is just too great. And this is one of these things where, you know, politicians shouldn't be left to the professionals. We have to stand up and demand better and say, no, this is not acceptable. You can't play with our lives. You can't play with the life of the planet. You can't play with the lives of species who have no say over any of this, right? We're the only ones who are stupid enough to make nuclear weapons. You know, we've got to walk back from the brink, and we've got to construct policies both in this country and around the world that are more for the people, for justice, for the planet, and that this militarism is just unacceptable and it's killing us.
Well, Kevin, it's really been good talking to you, and I want to thank you for helping remind us how we need to keep worrying about the bomb, the opposite of the subtitle of Dr. Strangelove.
Very good. My pleasure, Barbara.
We've been talking this morning with Kevin Martin, who's president of Peace Action, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest will be Scott Freeman, author of Saving Tarbo Creek. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Charles Mingus. Oh, Lord, don't drop that atomic bomb on me. Thanks for listening.
'Like to play a peace title. Oh, Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me. stop it, stop it, bebop it. Don't let him.